The Library of Congress just launched a new crowdsourcing campaign, the goal to expand access to unreleased law library documents dating back to the World War II era. For what it's all about, we turn to the director of the Law Library Editorial and Publishing Office, Luis Acosta. Mr. Acosta, good to have you on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Law Library Senior Legal Information Specialist, Stephen Mayu. Mr. Mayu, good to have you on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's begin with the context here. Mr. Acosta, what are the types of documents and extent of the documents that are involved in this campaign?
Well, so just by way of background, the Law Library of Congress has for really over a century now been doing reports on foreign law for Congress and for other, you know, federal agencies sometimes as well. They're somewhat similar to the reports that our more well-known sister agency, the Congressional Research Service, does. But when if a question from Congress comes into the Library of Congress that's about foreign law, the folks in the Law Library's Foreign Law Division, which is called the Global Legal Research Directorate, will be assigned to respond. And that's just sort of a historical, just the result of how things developed. The foreign law specialists are in the law library because they handle collections responsibilities as well as research responsibilities. So foreign law questions come to the Law Library of Congress. We've been doing these for, like I said, over a century, but it really picked up around the post-World War II era, and now we're now digitizing these.
Got it. So, Stephen, in other words, these are not available widely. They're all in paper, so you're digitizing them. Then tell us what the issue there is that you need a crowdsourcing campaign for.
Sure. As Luis said, we've been writing these reports for decades now. And in fact, many of them have already been added to the collection. But since about 2018, we started a project to inventory many of these historical paper reports that were not formerly part of the collection, as well as a few that were, but we thought would benefit from digitization. But many of these reports have been digitized from thin carbon copies, kind of like onion skin paper. And in some cases, these represent the only known remaining versions of the reports. So although they're still pretty legible to the human eye, the poor print quality makes their digitized characters difficult for optical character recognition or OCR. And that's why we enlisted the help of volunteers for this particular campaign.
And so you don't want to post just images of the fuzzy pages. You want to have the actual text available.
Exactly. Our goal is to have a fully searchable and accessible collection of these historical reports.
And what will the volunteers do then, precisely?
Well, if you're familiar with the platform, this is the By the People crowdsourcing platform. And I invite anyone listening to go to crowd.loc.gov. You would see an image on your left screen of the digitized report. And then on the right side of your screen, you'll have a transcription window. And we are asking volunteers to type what they see. And in fact, in this particular campaign, we have been successful enough to have an initial transcription of nearly all of the pages. I think all but maybe 10 or so pages have received an initial transcription. So what we need now are reviewers who are willing to go in and look at the transcription and confirm its accuracy and accept it. And at that point, it becomes added to the library's permanent collections.
Got it. We're speaking with Stephen Mayu. He's Senior Legal Information Specialist, and with Luis Acosta, Director of the Law Library Editorial and Publishing Office. They are both with the Library of Congress. And do people that do this comparison need to simply be good readers, or do they have to have some knowledge of law, for example?
Thank you for asking that. They do not need to have any knowledge of law. Anyone who is able to read the content in the image is welcome to participate. In fact, there are magnifying tools where you can zoom in and out. So we hope that many of these characters are easy enough to read. And in fact, we're looking for readers of languages for a small selection of these reports, which are foreign language translations of the U.S. Constitution. So if you're a speaker of Armenian, Chinese, or Russian, Korean, even maybe Hungarian, we are looking for those who can help us review those particular documents as well.
And Louise, from a content standpoint, I'm looking at a couple of pages here that have just at random having to do with visas for travel to Burma. I guess for a Burma shave, in 1966. I'm dating myself, sorry. And there are scribblings in some of the margins. There is a recurring footnote at the bottom of each page. I mean, this is when typists were really typists, when these were created way before computer-generated text. Is there any significance into what might be in some of the handwritten notes, or and the footnote can be reproduced just on the first page? And I mean, how does the formatting affect the content, and does the formatting need to somehow get moved forward in this effort?
As I said earlier, in some cases, these are the only remaining copies of the report. So it's possible that maybe this 1966 report was published in another format. But the one that we have, the one remaining copy, may have handwritten notes. And we invite volunteers to transcribe those in brackets as marginalia. So that will become part of the transcription of the report.
Got it. And Luis?
One never knows what a researcher who happens to be researching, you know, the situation in Burma in 1966 might find of interest. So it's too much for someone developing a collection to assume what future researchers might find interesting for one reason or another. So even such marginalia conceivably could be of interest.
Yeah, so that can get somehow moved forward into the digital age, even the margin notes.
Exactly.
And what about the situation, say, continuing with the Burma example, it's now called Myanmar. And is there some way for someone to, if they're interested in Myanmar, to be directed toward a document referring to Burma?
I can answer that, I think. As far as I understand, this particular report should have a catalog record. Another thing worth mentioning about this project is that it's a collaboration between us and GPO. The U.S. Government Publishing Office receives these records and they provide full bibliographic records. So they would have applied a subject term to the record for this particular report, which would link Burma and Myanmar. So a researcher would, by accessing the bibliographic record, be able to find other reports.
All right, Myanmar. So let's zoom out here again. You've got this interesting thousands of documents of collections that are going to be verified and some degree still to be transcribed, but mostly verified. To whom might this collection be of interest, do you think, in the future?
I think that this project presents the opportunity to engage new audiences with the works that have been written by the Law Library over many decades. I think our hope is that it would expand digital access, not only for legal historians, but also policymakers, scholars, foreign legal specialists who currently refer to contemporary law library reports, but also students of history and public policy, government, or international relations, as well as just the general interested members of the public.
And Luis, what is fascinating to you about this publication and this collection that might be interesting to the general public out there?
Well, as Stephen mentioned, I think this would be of interest to historians, political scientists, also people who are interested in the history of the federal government and indeed the history of the Library of Congress, anyone interested in the history of international relations, what the U.S. government was interested in during the time period in question, you know, historians of the Cold War, any number of historians and scholars might find these materials of interest.
All right. Luis Acosta is director of the Law Library Editorial and Publishing Office at the Library of Congress. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Stephen Mayu is Senior Legal Information Specialist at the Library. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
We'll post this interview along with a link to how you can help at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Rick Wade, Senior Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Outreach at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Previously, Rick was a Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. He worked closely with the Obama administration, and he also worked with Commerce's Economic Development Administration to foster regional economic development in distressed areas and with the Minority Business Development Agency to create jobs through the growth of minority-owned businesses. He received a BS from the University of South Carolina and an MPA from Harvard University. Rick, welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
And thank you so much for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Rick, in today's environment, leaders have had to adapt and find new ways to lead with transparency and empathy. But can you tell us a bit about how you've adapted your leadership style?
You know, this past year has clearly presented some unique challenges that certainly me, or I as a leader, have had to adapt. You think about a pandemic, for example, that has placed us in probably one of the most challenging circumstances is to sort of lead in a virtual world now. I've not been in my office for nearly a year. And the idea that we don't have the human interaction, which I think is very important when you think about the empathy that is a very important value of leadership. So trying to lead from a virtual environment, Shane, and be empathetic and be sensitive to the needs of others has presented a terribly difficult challenge. One of the other defining moments, I think, in our time that has dictated a change in leadership, if you will, was the murder of George Floyd. I think it created a whole different consciousness in America and certainly within me about the importance of being empathetic in the way I lead, to be inclusive, to lead in a way in which you're very sensitive to the impact of your decisions on others across our community. So it certainly has been a challenging year to adapt, but I'm happy to say that I'm still here and we're moving forward.
Perfect. Throughout your career, what have been some pivotal moments or lessons learned that have shaped the leader that you are today?
You know, there have been so many moments, Shane. I grew up in rural South Carolina. Quite honestly, at a time when I saw what legal segregation was. I mean, I wasn't able to go to an integrated school until middle school, being bused across town. And I remember, as strangely as it may sound, in 1979, I wanted to run for vice president of my student body at Lancaster High School, a rural school. And I had to run on the ballot as vice president Black, literally. And there was another candidate who ran as vice president White. And the irony of that story is that the following year, I ran for president and I won overwhelmingly. That was a lesson for me in leadership. And the lesson there was, you know, perseverance, have the tenacity, have a vision, and overcoming barriers. And I didn't let the idea that the construct that I had to run as vice president deter me from reaching my bigger dream, which was to represent students. So I know that's that perhaps may be a small example of leadership, but it really did define how I view myself, the vision that I have, my willingness to fight for change. And that was the beginning. I think that set the foundation of how I lead. And there've been so many other moments. One of the most defining moments for me personally was the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A very close friend of mine, Senator Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who lost his life. And it conjured up, again, these issues of how deep the divide in terms of race in America is. But it also inspired me to lead even more and to lead harder and to lead with diligence and vigilance to help close that divide. So there have been so many defining moments in my career. I will tell you, even after the murder of George Floyd and my role at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to galvanize the business community inspired by that tragedy. And now we have a whole broad, historic, sweeping, what we call Equality of Opportunity Initiative that I'm leading, that I was inspired to develop. And we're bringing together corporations from across America to address what we call equality of opportunity. So my point there, I think with all of these moments, they've all been pivotal moments at different parts of my life, my career, my journey. And I've seized those moments to make the best of them, of what I could.
That's fantastic. It's a great, great answer. Many stories. Thank you very much for sharing that. Who is the most impactful leader in your life? And what quality did you admire about them?
You know, I can't say that I had just one, but I would tell you the one person whose historical leadership has inspired me the most, and that is the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there's so many attributes there that are consistent with my values. But the one part of his leadership was vision. And I mean, the idea that you can have a dream, which we often define and think of his big I have a dream speech. But I think that's a really important attribute of leadership, Shane, that you can sort of see beyond the challenges of today and see a better future for people and for yourself. So the idea that leaders have vision despite the challenges is seeing a forest despite the trees. It's seeing an opportunity despite the barriers. And that attribute, I think, is one that I embody. I mean, I'm very optimistic despite the challenges, despite the circumstances. So the whole notion of vision was a very important attribute that I learned and that I've tried to emulate from the leadership of Dr. King.
Wow, fantastic. And as someone who's got an extensive background in federal service and out of federal service, what advice would you give to feds looking to develop leadership skills? And you can talk about mid-career, senior career, early career. What comes to mind there?
Yeah, listen, I mean, you're aware that I had the fortunate opportunity. We didn't have a Secretary of Commerce when President Obama, of course, I served as one of his senior advisors, was inaugurated. And the president asked me to go to the Department of Commerce to hold the fort down. And that was one of the most exciting experiences in my entire career, not just for the title and the wonderful experiences, but I understood the value of federal employees. And folks forget sometimes, Shane, that we political appointees, we come and go. But the folks who are grinding every day, who are at their desk no matter rain, sleet, or snow, who bring innovations but yet don't get the credit for it because the political appointees get all the credit. I think I learned something about the humility of being a leader. I built so many friends who were federal employees, not just at the manager level, but the frontline workers, the administrative assistants. And I was very deliberate. I mean, one of the things that I was most proud of, strangely enough, I was that guy, even though I was senior advisor to the Secretary of Commerce. And my office was on the floor, the top floor. We call it the blue carpet, Shane. But I made a deliberate point to go eat in the cafeteria every day, as many days as I could, just to sit down and talk with employees. And I grew from that. And there were so many times where I took their ideas back to the blue carpet and said, and I told the Secretary Locke, you got to go down and sit down and talk with regular, common, everyday folks. They're in the cafeteria, not in the dining room on the blue carpet. And so he started doing that. So the point is, I think for me, the advice that I would give is to continue to do the hard work. I do think that we should do a better job in government in providing the kind of admiration for those workers as we do the high level appointees. And that may be something that that I'm looking to work on myself to help continue to advocate for our federal employees. Those are the hard workers. That's where the work gets done. And so I think that's a lesson for me. If there was some advice and counsel I could give, is to continue to do your work, but we have to do our work as leaders of these agencies to create ladders of success and reward and admiration for the hard work that they do.
Rick, thank you very much. You've inspired me. These are tremendous insights and stories. I love every single one of them. You've got a fascinating journey in leadership yourself. And thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Thank you for listening to today's Lessons in Leadership podcast. And until we see you next time, take good care.